Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 and 95.9 FM. Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, right here on the show. Along the way, if you have a question, feel free to call it in or text it in. You can certainly do that at 806-745-5800. That's 806-745-5800 along the way. Let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards. Good morning, sir.
Hey, Wade. Good morning.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Another great Monday morning.
Right.
Got a great show today. It's just me, but I'm going to talk a little bit about... I'm going to try to relate COVID-19 and heart disease and seed oils. So last week's show, if you didn't hear it, I highly recommend you go back and listen to Dr. Chris Kenobi, UT Southwestern Medical School professor, researcher. He's an ophthalmologist, and he's very much a proponent of eating ancestral food. Eat like your great-great-grandparents did. Eat like human beings have eaten for the last many thousands of years before we started to adulterate food. And he made a great case for these industrialized seed oils being the root cause of the inflammatory oxidative stress that we see with all these different diseases. So I encourage everybody to go back and listen to that. And I did have a couple of questions or a few questions that were emailed in over the last week after the show. So we'll clarify some of that. And one of the questions was about avocado oil, coconut oil, olive oil. These aren't the animal fats, which Dr. Kenobi was a big proponent of, as am I. Those are fine. So the coconut, avocado, and olive oils, no problem. However, those do not contain the fat-soluble vitamins that Dr. Weston A. Price found 100 years ago in his research when he traveled the world, spent 20 years with 14 different people groups around the world, from the Maasai tribe in Africa to the South Pacific Islanders to the Oriental groups, Native Americans, South American Native tribes. And what he found was these fat-soluble vitamins, which are vitamin A, D, E, and K, which are found in animal tissues, animal fat. These were key components of health. It's what Dr. Kenobi was getting at last week. It's what we've talked about many times with Morley Robbins. The minerals, magnesium and copper in particular, work in synergy with these fat-soluble vitamins that are found from animal fats. So avocado oil, coconut oil, and olive oil do not have those vitamins, and that's why I recommend not just doing those only. So the pro-inflammatory oils that we were talking about last week with Dr. Kenobi, those are the seed oils, rape seed, which is canola oil, soybean oil, corn oil, grape seed oil, safflower oil. These pro-inflammatory PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids, or the kind of scientific name for that, these are very oxidizable. And if you remember back with all the Morley shows, we talk about oxidation. When oxygen reacts with iron in particular, you rust on the from the inside out. Well, that same process happens. Iron mixes with these lipids. Your cell membranes are made of fat. So if the fats that you're eating are these oxidizable fats, these easily oxidizable fats that are found in the vegetable oils, then that's a perfect recipe for inflammation, oxidative stress. I found it fascinating what Dr. Kenobi's research. I did not dive into the research as deep as he has as far as the historical nature of cardiovascular disease. The first heart attack ever recorded in America, he reported last week, 1912. There was one heart attack in the entire country reported in the medical literature. One in 1912. Prior to that, there was no documented heart attacks, including from Sir William Osler, the founder of modern medicine, the founder of John Hopkins Medical School. And he was interviewed at the turn of the century, and he thought back over the past 20 years, so into the late 1800s of his career, he could recount zero cases of heart attacks. He reported about 8 cases of angina, the chest pain that comes from coronary blockage. So fascinating stuff. And so Dr. Kenobi's research just really points to a correlation, a pattern, as we see the increase of cottonseed oils, the first seed oil. I forgot to mention that earlier. But cottonseed was the first PUFA to come on the market. Crisco, margarine, then all the other seed oils came into play. So really encourage everybody to go look at that. And we're going to talk in a minute, how could the American Heart Association be recommending the exact opposite thing than what Dr. Kenobi's proposing in his theory, the root cause of all of this inflammation. We'll get into that. But hopefully that answers the question on those oils. It's fine to use avocado, olive oil, coconut oil, but it's those seed oils, in particular soy, corn, canola, and cottonseed, which, by the way, are the most common ones. Are the cheapest ones, so you'll find them in all the packaged processed food, and you'll find them in restaurant food, unfortunately.
What about those oils that, when you talk about grapeseed oil and avocado and things like that, people, some cooks would say, oh, well, that doesn't have a high enough burn point to really do the job well on certain foods.
Right.
Well, what about that?
Yeah, that's kind of a secondary issue. When you're going to cook with an oil, you need to know the smoke point.
Mm-hmm.
What's the temperature that it goes, that it burns,
right,
basically. Burns,
right, right,
and goes rancid and smokes. And so avocado oil, it's in the 500-degree range. So that's fine to, like, even make fried chicken or chicken fried steak. If you want to use a real high temperature, go avocado oil.
Oh, gotcha.
Coconut oil, it's somewhere around 325, 350. And then olive oil is lower, like 280, something like that. People can look these up, but the generally it's in that range. So you'd want to do a light saute. If you're going to use the olive oil, don't do a high heat, or just use olive oil cold, you know, dressings and stuff. So that's kind of a separate deal. Any oil, if it's damaged enough by heat, but the problem with these, the oils we're talking about, the seed oils, cottonseed,
yeah,
soy, corn, these are easily turn rancid just by oxygen, just by being exposed to oxygen. So you press those seeds and this oil comes out, it's oxidized. You're eating oxidized fats. Those fats become part of your cell membrane. As Dr. Kenobi talked about last week, these particular fats get stored in your adipose tissue and you can't burn them. You cannot, you know, get on the treadmill and go burn some calories and burn fat. These don't burn.
These are the omega-6s.
Yes, those pro-inflammatory omega-6 from the vegetable oils. So they get stored, very difficult to get rid of them. And that's why some doctors would say, even more than sugar and processed flour, these are the most important things to remove from your diet, because they get incorporated into your membranes.
Wow.
Every cell
That's
membrane,
amazing.
The membranes inside
More
your cell,
than
like
sugar?
The mitochondrial membrane, yeah.
Wow.
So if you were going to only remove one thing, that would probably be the thing to remove. But where you remove that, it's processed food. So that's the beauty. You remove that processed food, you're going to automatically remove the processed sugars and processed grains too.
Yeah, true.
So hopefully that cleared that up. There was another question about, this is unrelated, this is going to COVID. I had someone email or text Facebook or something. When's this going to end? One of my Facebook Lives a couple weeks ago talked about in Texas we'd be done on the 25th of August, which is tomorrow. And that prediction was by Dr. Michael Levitt, who I've quoted many times. He's a Nobel laureate. He's a Stanford professor, well-respected guy. And he started making these predictions back in March. He predicted when Sweden would be done. And when I say done, I'm talking about the death, the unusual high spike in death. We'd be back to our normal weekly death toll as an average day, weekly death that we see every week in America. So he predicted that for Sweden, for Italy, for all these countries. And I've talked about these curves before on my Facebook Lives. I encourage people to go back and watch those if you didn't get them, or on our YouTube channel, which is Veritas Wellness on YouTube. It's on there. And so he just applied that curve to the southern latitude, so any state below the 35th parallel. And again, I talked about this 35th parallel and viral respiratory illness in my data summary. Go look that up on Veritas Wellness YouTube. I did an hour-long presentation on that. So there was a Dr. Edgar Hope who published a book years ago when this has been identified that if you're below the 35th latitude, your viral death curve is going to come later than the northern latitudes, and it's going to be a little more shallow or flat. It's exactly what we saw. Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, the exact curve that has been in the literature for years and that Dr. Leavitt predicted it occurred. So I'm not talking about number of new cases, how many swabs are coming back positive. That is so controversial because it's about 50% of those tests are wrong, either false positive or false negative. You can't go by COVID deaths because even CDC has come out and said the COVID deaths, the number of deaths marked COVID, are skewed because of financial incentive per the CDC. And we've heard a number of anecdotal reports of, you know, someone dying of trauma, like a motorcycle accident, and that being labeled COVID-19, or a heart attack, and that being labeled COVID-19. So I'm not going to get into that. We can't use that for accurate analysis of the COVID-19 situation. We can't use positive cases or COVID deaths. We have to look at all-cause mortality. How many people died this week in America? How many people died last week and every week of this whole year? And again, I've talked about this a number of times on the live videos, so go back and look at them. But basically, and Dr. Dennis Rancourt really goes deep into these numbers, and he's shown the spike of flu and pneumonia illness every year, 2014, 2015, 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20, and this one, and we are no different than a typical respiratory death year. So yes, there are people dying from these respiratory viruses, as they do every year. And the all-cause mortality is not that much different at all. In some cases, depending on the year, it's even a little bit lower. So when will this be over? The death curve, I think it's clear that the abnormal deaths, I agree with Dr. Leavitt at Stanford, that curve is done. It's been done in Europe. It's been done in New York. Now it's done here. So what does the news media report on? Positive cases. Don't listen to that. Unfortunately, I wish they'd report on the death curve because that would bring a little more reality and factual truthfulness to this situation. I want to point out one other thing, and then we'll get into what I really want to talk about. Dr. Lee Cowden, who I had on the show a month or two ago, sent me a study, encouraged me to look at this, and I had not seen it on any other news outlet, any media. You can go look it up yourself. C, as in cat, C19study.com. What this study, it's an international study from around the world. It's a controlled meta-analysis. What that means is a meta-analysis will go back and look at all the different studies of whatever they're looking at. So this particular study is looking at COVID-19 and hydroxychloroquine, which I'm not sure if I'm even allowed to say the name of that drug, but I'm going to go ahead and say it, which, by the way, it's been around for 60 years. I took it when I went to Africa for prophylaxis for malaria. I prescribed it for many years for autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. It's been around a long time. Generally accepted as safe by the WHO before COVID-19 came on the scene. So back to the study. C19study.com, a controlled meta-analysis, 68 published studies. It looked at it, averaged out 68 published studies, 41 peer-reviewed. All these studies combined accounted for 2.6 billion people with a B. That's a huge, huge meta-analysis. 68 studies, 2.6 billion people, and what it showed, on average, a 79% reduction in death rate with hydroxychloroquine started early in the disease process. If you apply 79% reduction to even the inflated COVID-19 death numbers, what are we at, 170,000, 175,000? Do the math on that. Multiply 170,000 times 79% and subtract that off. We will be well below a normal flu season death rate. So, again, this is a very large study. Hard to refute such a large study. An average of 68 published studies, 2.6 billion people on using hydroxychloroquine around the world showed a 79% reduction in death rate. The doctors that got up on the steps of the Supreme Court that basically were saying the same thing, they didn't have this study to point to yet, were censored and basically mocked and ridiculed. And everyone pointed to the two studies that early on the government was pointing to that said, no, hydroxychloroquine doesn't work. Those two studies in the New England Journal and the Lancet both retracted, which is pretty unheard of. Both those studies retracted because it turned out they were awful studies. They were using mega high doses in the range of 2,200 milligrams when you're supposed to use 200 milligrams. And they were using it too often, and they were using it in these very, very, very sick patients in the ICU, where it's well known now you use it early in the process and you only do 200 milligrams a couple times a week or maybe daily, depending on the study you look at. So completely different. It's apples and oranges. Those studies were doomed, destined to fail. Those patients were already probably destined to have poor outcomes, and then you basically gave them a toxic dose. And that's why those studies were retracted. But those were the two studies that were used to pretty much say hydroxychloroquine should not be used. So y'all check out that study, C19.com. Okay, so to answer the question, when's this going to be over? I can't tell you. I'm not a politician. I'm just a doctor. That was a meme. Someone sent me this meme. Said, "Doc, when's this going to be over?" I don't know. I'm just a doctor. I'm not a politician. If you look at the data, if you look at the death curve, it is over. You know, kids have the mortality rate in kids is practically zero if you're under age 50. We've talked about that before. It doesn't impact kids hardly at all. So why are all the kids at school being treated the way they are? That's a whole other debate I'm not going to get into. The mask, I've talked about this before. I mean, my patients, we attract patients that demand answers because, number one, they've been hurt by the medical community at large, and they come to our clinic desperate and looking for a different answer or looking for an ear to listen to them, and we give them 1 to 2 hours, so we do listen to them. But they also demand evidence. They don't just take things for face value. They're not just going to do what the doctor says, like in most clinics. So our patients, thank you, patients, have spurred me on. Unfortunately, I should have been doing this from the very first day I left medical school. I should have been doing my own self-study into the literature. But these patients that spur me on to do this, I mean, if I'm going to tell them to take a vaccine or wear a mask, they want data. They want true informed consent. They want me to show them the papers that show safety and efficacy. Does this medical intervention work? Where's the data? Is it safe? Where's the data? What are the side effects? How many side effects are there? What's the percentage of the side effects? Where are the odds I'm going to have the side effect? And if I can show them data that shows their benefit is way up here and their risk is way down here, then maybe they'll choose to do this medical intervention on their loved one or on themselves. Our patients demand it. I believe ethically and legally doctors are required to do this. Unfortunately, most doctors don't have the full education to be able to do this. So I went and looked up studies, and I already presented these where it shows that masks, not only do they not filter the virus for healthy people that aren't coughing, trying to filter the virus coming in or going out, it doesn't work. And there are studies that show it actually worsens the local environment that they're breathing, which is common sense. That's your exhaust. You're exhaling your exhaust, your waste, your carbon dioxide, and moisture is with that. So we're going to trap the moisture, trap that exhalation, trap the carbon dioxide, change the CO2 O2 ratio in the local environment that you're breathing in and out. And so some of these studies showed you actually increase your risk of influenza or influenza-like illness when you wear the mask. And then Dr., he's a neurosurgeon, Russell Blaylock, colleague of mine, neurosurgeon turned more holistic doctor, and he looked at 17 different studies that he could find, peer-reviewed studies, and zero of those studies showed benefit for transmission of respiratory viruses and wearing these cloth masks or surgical masks. Then Dr. Tenpenny reviewed 50 studies and found the same thing, no evidence of benefit. And then Dr. Dennis Rancourt studied every study he could find that was a quality study, and he found the same thing, no benefit. So when I have a patient ask me to show me the proof, and I go look for the proof and I can't find it, then we're down to, hey, this is just a recommendation from a government organization versus here's the medical literature I can find. Then you have to decide for yourself. So when's the social distancing and the regulations at school and the mask wearing and all that going to come to an end? I can't say because I can't point to the data that says here's why we're even doing it to begin with. Yes, if you're coughing, you cover your cough. I'm not arguing that. That's common sense again. And if you're sick, you quarantine yourself. You quarantine the sick. You quarantine the at-risk. You cover your cough. These are basic things. And otherwise, you boost your immune system. That's what we should be doing. So logic, common sense, peer-reviewed data has been so skewed or not looked at or not presented fully, not talked about fully, it makes it impossible for me to say, when will this be over? All right.
I say November 3rd, it'll be over.
You're probably right, Wade.
Yeah, let's just go with that.
I'm going to set up the second half of the show because we're probably going to have to take a break. Because what I'm about to get into, this is from a book I'm reading, Fat and Cholesterol Don't Cause Heart Attacks and Statins Are Not the Solution. It's an amazing book. Any doctor that calls me, including cardiologists that call me and want to know, why do you promote diet and lifestyle so much and why can't you get in line with X, Y, and Z, I'll tell them, just read the first 20 pages of this book. It's an incredible book, and I'm quoting from the back cover of it. And this quote is from George Mann, former co-director of the Framingham Study. Now, I know the Framingham Study probably means nothing to the listeners, but I promise you, go ask your doctor, have you heard of the Framingham Study? Guarantee you. Every single doctor, conventional doctors, heard of the Framingham Study. It's like the biggest epidemiological study. It's from Framingham, outside of Boston, I believe, this little town. So this is back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. They followed like 20,000 people in this town for all these different health outcomes based on their diet and lifestyle and other factors. It's just a huge study that we learned about in medical school, and doctors quote from it all the time. So this is the former co-director of the Framingham Study, George Mann. And the Framingham Study is really what launched the cholesterol heart disease hypothesis and then into the lipid-lowering, the cholesterol-lowering drugs. Quote, the greatest scientific deception of this century, perhaps of any century, that's a direct quote from George Mann, former director of the Framingham Study. What he's talking about is the cholesterol heart disease hypothesis theory. The greatest scientific deception of this century, perhaps of any century. I'd like to ask George Mann if he'd still say that in regards comparing it to the COVID-19 lack of full disclosure of what's in the literature. But we're going to get into that in a minute, and we're going to talk about how the American Heart Association accepts money to the tune of $700,000 for a product to be able to put the little heart with a red check. If you remember, like, think of Cheerios, heart healthy. The heart healthy vegetable oils, the heart healthy Cheerios, the heart healthy grape juice full of sugar, all these heart healthy items, they can't just put that American Heart Association logo on there with a check and a heart. They have to apply and pay a fee. And according to this book, and I'm going to get into the details of it when we get back from the break, to the tune of $700,000 to the American Heart Association. And the American Heart Association's annual revenue, $8 million. This book, it was published 2016, so this data is probably a little old. Massive conflict of interest, massive financial entanglement between these institutional organizations and peer-reviewed data. We're going to talk about how scientists were defunded and could not get a job for 2 years when they questioned this cholesterol hypothesis. And the reason I really want to talk about this, number one, it relates to last week's show with Dr. Kenobi, the first heart attack ever recorded in 1912, and now 600,000, 700,000 people are going to die this year from heart disease in America. And every year, it's the number one killer. How did we go from 1 to 700,000? So it's related to that, but it also relates to people need to understand, why are they not getting the full story, both sides? Why are we not having a rigorous, fiery, healthy First Amendment debate on to develop policies for COVID-19? Why? Why aren't we? Why do we not get to hear from those frontline doctors? Why does this C19.com study, 2.6 billion people, why is it not headlined everywhere? Why is it not influencing Governor Abbott's medical advisor team on their policy decisions? Why? Why would the American Heart Association recommend vegetable oils that Dr. Kenobi's research is saying that's the root cause of heart attacks? In fact, he said last week, you cannot have a heart attack. In his opinion, based off his research and study of the evidence, he said you cannot have a heart attack without consuming these vegetables. You have to consume heart-healthy vegetables in order to produce the pathophysiology causing heart attacks.
Real quick on the text line, someone's asking, saying, well, they say the asymptomatic people can cause COVID-19, and that's one reason why the mask. Please explain, if you can, that that's not true. Or
how would the virus from an asymptomatic person get to the next person? You would cough on them. So if you're coughing, wear a mask or cover your cough somehow. But that, again, is a symptom. And what's clear now, that this virus is just in the air. So it's the airborne, aerosolized viral particles that are in the air itself. People are breathing air. These viral particles are in the air. So it's not these mucus or water droplets that someone's just coughing right in. Yes, you could get it that way if someone's just coughing right in your face. But the point is that the literature is pretty clear now that the aerosolized particles are the way this transmits, so it's just in the air.
And that cloth mask won't prevent that.
Right. If air is getting through it, which it is, obviously, because you're breathing, then these small particles are getting through it too.
Right through the cloth mask, okay.
So definitely cover your cough, because that's the way it would spread. But otherwise, and that goes to the whole germ theory, terrain theory. There's 1 to the 31st power viruses in our air, not COVID-19 viruses, different. 1 to the 31 different types of viruses in the air, 1 to the 30th power in the water, and 1 to the 30th power in the soil. These viruses are everywhere. They're part of us. A newborn baby, first moment of life, their gut's sterile. They get inoculated with their mom's bacteria from the vaginal birth canal. But within 7 days, they've got 1 × 10⁷ power, I believe it is. And again, these are all on previous videos, of viruses in their gut. So these viruses are just part of our environment. If 81% of people are already immune, and 80% of people don't have symptoms, that clearly shows us that our immune system is able to take these viruses in constantly with every breath, with every swallow, and neutralize them and do something with them. So it's all about your immune system's ability to trap and capture. And hopefully at the end of the show, we'll have time to talk about our God-given mask, our nose. Because next week's show, I've already recorded it, The Oxygen Advantage is a book by Patrick McKeon. He's an Irishman. Be a little bit hard to understand him next week because of his accent, but it was a great interview. And he talks about breathing, nasal breathing in particular. It's incredible when you breathe through your nose. The nostrils are so small in diameter, the air speeds up. But then it opens into this chamber, your sinus passages. It's a big chamber, so the air automatically slows down. But then there's these little bumpers, these stoppers called nasal turbinates or sinus turbinates. And that causes the air to start circulating in a motion. And what the aerodynamics, the flow properties of the air in the sinus cavity causes the particles to drop to the base of the cavity. That's where the mucus is, and the mucus grabs it. The mucus travels all the way down into your stomach, from your sinuses into your stomach. And then the stomach's pH is 1 to 2, battery acid, and it kills all these germs. It's an amazing system. And on top of that, nitric oxide, when you nasally breathe, not mouth breathe, and when that air flow dynamic is right, meaning there's no mask, external mask to impede this, you get fast motion of the air through the nostrils. Then it slows down in the sinus. The turbinates hit it and cause it to circulate. It drops the particles, traps it in the mucus. Nitric oxide, which is a gas, gets produced. And this is antimicrobial. We couldn't have dreamed up of a better system. We're going to squirt basically I'll call it hand sanitizer, but it's way better than that. We're going to squirt a disinfectant, a natural disinfectant that doesn't harm you, nitric oxide, into this chamber where the air just got slowed down and it dropped the particles out of it into the mucus. And then we've got all the hair fibers and we got all the mucus going down our airway. It's an incredible system. You cannot improve on God. That's the bottom line. Why do people with the highest cholesterol live the longest? Because cholesterol plays a vital role in our physiology. You can't improve on God. If you artificially drop that with a drug, it has unintended consequences. We're going to talk about that when we get back from the break. People with the highest cholesterol live the longest. People that lower their cholesterol, according to the Framingham study, I got a quick quote in this because we got to get to the break. I'll quote it when we get back. You're going to be shocked at people that eat less saturated fat and less cholesterol have the egg white omelet. Guess what happens to their serum cholesterol and what happens to their heart disease rates? If you'd ask any general public or doctor, they'd tell you, well, it'll drop their cholesterol and it'll drop their heart disease rates. When we come back from the break, I'll show you what the Framingham study showed. And we'll get into other research, too. We'll get into more truth and more hopefully convincing you that our physiology was designed beautifully and perfectly. If we'll steward it properly with nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace, then you'll be well. You don't have to worry about germs or genes. All of this you'll learn about in our class. VeritasWellness.health is a website that will direct you to a class, a one-hour class for 4 weeks with our wellness navigators. There's videos done by me. You'll watch the videos and you'll show up in class for an hour on Zoom and you'll do Q&A with the wellness navigators and they will teach you how to change your diet and lifestyle, how to cook different, how to shop different, how to eat out different, how to do all this differently through the 4 weeks. You can do one-on-ones with the navigators, but the idea is these small group classes, 7 to 10 people per class. The times are on there. We're starting at the first of every month. We'll start a new series of classes, multiple options of times, morning, noon, evenings, weekends, weekdays. So get on there, VeritasWellness.health. It's a very affordable at this point. And get educated on how to not need a doctor and on how to be healthy. Stick with us. This is Ben Edwards. You're the Cure.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 and 95.9 FM with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Also, check out VeritasWellness.health. That's the place to go for a lot of great information. You'll find it there, VeritasWellness.health. Of course, along the way, if you have any questions, feel free to do that. Text line always open and available, 806-745-5800. That's 806-745-5800. All right, let's go to the text line. I know we'll get right into it. We've got a lot of text to get to today. We'll try to get to as many as we can. But one question is, well, what do individuals do that have been diagnosed with heart disease and or have had open heart surgery do? The occlusion and the damage is there. Now what? Where do we go from there?
Do the same thing everybody else should be doing. Eat ancestrally, move every day, be at peace, and stay well hydrated. Take the class at VeritasWellness.health to get the details on that. But you need to remember, your body remodels itself all the time. You're making a whole new you all the time. Your cells die every day, and you make new ones every day. The rods and cones in the back of your eye every 48 hours. Liver cells every 8 weeks. The lining of your gut every 4 days. Skin cells every 4 weeks. Red blood cells every 90 days, roughly. So you're regenerating a whole you new all the time, new cells all the time. You'll make new heart muscle cells. You'll make new blood vessels. So your body grows its own bypasses. They're called collaterals. So when there starts to be a blockage in the body senses that, knows that, and will grow a bypass around it. The cause of most heart attacks is not because your widowmaker got, you know, 50% blocked, then 70%, 80%, 90%, then oops, 100% blockage, have a heart attack. That's exceedingly rare. That's like, you know, the literature says less than 10% of the heart attacks are from that method. Why? Because the body grows a bypass. That's why studies show that coronary artery bypass disease, surgeries. You do a bypass surgery, the studies have shown it does not decrease your risk of a future heart attack or death from a future heart attack. How could that be? Because it's not addressing the root cause. The root cause, like Dr. Kenobi talked about last week, was inflammation. It's these inflamed plaques. And the cardiologists will tell you this too. It's when a plaque that's inflamed ruptures. So imagine your coronary artery with a bunch of pimples like zits, and they rupture. This pus just ruptures out. Then the body comes to put a patch on that ruptured plaque, that ruptured artheroma or zit inside your coronary. And it's that quick, aggressive clot that's being laid down to try to patch that that bursting artheroma that causes the heart attack. So you can have 0% blockage, actually, but if you have an inflamed artheroma that ruptures and you quickly, in a matter of seconds to minutes, you build this clot and it blocks the entire artery, that's the real issue. So you need to deal with inflammation, to answer the question. But that's the same across the board. Whether you're talking Alzheimer's or stroke or dementia or depression or autoimmune or you name it, it's inflammation, inflammation, inflammation. So we've got to get our mind off this disease. You know, there's this one disease like a heart disease, and there's another disease like Alzheimer's. No, it's all inflammation. That's what Dr. Kenobi's paper is all about. So go to his website, cureamd.org, and read his published study that's on there, and it talks about this. It's what we've talked about with Morley Robbins so many times. It's this oxidative stress and inflammation. We've got to get deeper down to figure out what's triggering the fire. And what you'll find is it's processed food. It's sedentary lifestyle, it's smoking, it's sugar, it's these polyunsaturated seed oils, heart-healthy oils. It's the excess iron in our diet from iron-fortified food. It's the lack of magnesium, bioavailable copper, and retinol. We've talked about it ad nauseum with Morley. This is what you would do. If you want to get to the very root of disease, why did people pre-1912 not have heart attacks in America? Why do the Maasai tribe in Africa have zero heart disease? Why do the South Pacific Islanders that Dr. Kenobi talked about have zero heart disease, even though they're eating tons of saturated fat? So another answer to the texter would be read this book, Fat and Cholesterol Don't Cause Heart Attacks. That'd be a great first step, and then take our class, VeritasWellness.health. Okay, so where does fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, heart disease hypothesis come from? 100 years ago, and I'm going to read some from this book. 100 years ago, there was a study that kind of kicked this whole thing off. It was a feeding study of rabbits. So what they did was they took rabbits, gave them purified cholesterol that they had obtained from egg yolks. They fed these rabbits this egg yolk for 2 to 3 months, and it produced these cholesterol-laden lesions in the aorta and in the other arteries. The problem with that is rabbits are not carnivore. Rabbits don't eat meat. Rabbits don't eat animal products. So we gave an herbivore a food that is toxic and foreign. It's a foreign substance. That rabbit has no mechanism to deal with these food products or these toxic substances. Furthermore, the blood levels of these rabbits were 4 to 5 times higher than what you see in any human. So that was the first study that got people thinking, maybe there's an issue with cholesterol if you eat it. But then they tried to repeat the studies in rodents, because rodents are carnivores, and other carnivorous animals. And guess what? They didn't see the same results. So, translation is not relevant to humans. In rabbits who don't eat animals, it looked to be an issue. In animals that do eat animal products, it was not an issue. So it should not have correlated at all to humans. But the theory was put out there, and it gained some traction. And then people that had bias came along. But really, pre-1920, which was when this first study on rabbits came along, everyone kind of blew it off and ignored it because there were no heart attacks. There was no heart disease in 1910 and 1920. So doctors didn't really care about this study back then because they didn't see any heart attacks in their practice. Their hospitals did not have heart attack victims in it. But come along into the 1950s, as Dr. Kenobi talks about, by even 1930, we're seeing, I think, 300,000 heart disease cases a year. In 1950, it's even higher. So Eisenhower had his heart attack in the late 1950s. Everyone turned to Ansel Keys, who was not a doctor, but he was a nutritionist. And he developed the K rations in World War II, so he was kind of an American hero, helped our troops win the war. Dr. Keys produced a study. This study landed him on the front page of Time magazine January 13th, 1961. What did Mr. Keys' study show? He showed the countries that eat the most butter and eggs and saturated fat with cholesterol have the most heart attacks. It was a direct linear relationship, correlation. The countries that eat the most fat, saturated fat, have the most heart attacks. Seven countries. So that's really, when you trace the history back, that's where it really lands. The problem with that study was it was biased and fraudulent, meaning he didn't produce all the data. It wasn't a 7-country study. It was a 22-country study. He cherry-picked the countries he wanted to support his bias. He could have picked Israel, Sweden, and Germany, and France. And if he would have picked those four countries, the conclusion would have been exactly opposite. The countries that eat the most butter and eggs and saturated fat had the least heart attacks because those countries showed that. Well, he just omitted that data. And he omitted other countries, too. He only cherry-picked seven countries that supported his bias. Put him on the front page of the Time magazine, and we're off to the races. So, 1957 comes along. They decided to try to replicate or prove Dr. Key's hypothesis. The Anti-Coronary Club Project, launched in 1957, set out to compare two groups of middle-aged New York businessmen. It was called the Prudent Diet. So this prudent diet, what they did is gave half of these businessmen a diet of corn oil, margarine instead of butter, and cold cereal rather than eggs, and chicken and fish instead of beef. So that you would call that today a heart-healthy diet. Chicken, beef, low in saturated fat, margarine, and corn oil. A heart-healthy oil, quote-unquote. That was in the one group. The second group of New York businessmen, they let them just eat their normal diet, and they could eat eggs and meat, and they did. So what they showed was, after one decade of watching these guys, cholesterol levels of those on the prudent diet were slightly lower. So if you ate corn oil and margarine, you had lower cholesterol than the group eating eggs and meat. But there were 8 deaths from heart disease compared to 0 deaths from heart disease, 8 deaths in the corn oil margarine group, 0 deaths in the meat and egg group. So that was the first real study to compare this diet, heart-healthy, quote-unquote heart-healthy diet, in 1957. Ansel Keys himself went on to do multiple feeding studies to try to prove his hypothesis. 20 years later, Ansel Keys, to his credit, retracted his statement. And so in a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine 20 years later, after he was put on the cover of Time magazine, quote, "There's no connection whatsoever between cholesterol in food and cholesterol in the blood, and we've known that all along. Cholesterol in the diet doesn't matter at all unless you happen to be a chicken or a rabbit." That is a direct quote from Ansel Keys. So let's keep moving. That was in the late 70s. So the Framingham study that I mentioned earlier, this study has had more impact on coronary heart disease research than any other epidemiological project. So the NIH, National Institutes of Health, 1950, started the Framingham study to try to validate this lipid hypothesis. They followed 28,000 residents of Framingham, a small manufacturing town near Boston. They were looking for solid evidence to prove the theory that they believed in. The people that started this study believed saturated fat, cholesterol in the diet would cause heart attacks. That's what they set out to prove. All right, so did it prove it? Here's what William Cannell, director of Framingham Study from 1966 to 1979, after 30 years of analyzing the data, for each 1% milligram drop in cholesterol, there was an 11% increase in coronary and total mortality. I'm going to repeat that because I'm telling you guys, your doctor, go to your clinic, call them up, send them a letter, go shoot them a Facebook message and ask them, hey, does the Framingham study show that eating a heart-healthy diet and reducing saturated fat in your diet and reducing cholesterol in your diet, does it show a decrease in heart disease? Almost guarantee you they're going to say, yes, it does. Ask your cardiologist the same question. I'm quoting you from the Framingham study director. For each 1% milligram drop in cholesterol, remember it dropped because they changed their diet to less saturated fat. For every 1 milligram drop in cholesterol, there was an 11% increase in coronary death and total death. Although the study showed this drop in cholesterol was associated with increased coronary death, this study, the Framingham study, was cited as supporting the cholesterol coronary link. And what the public read in a joint release from the American Heart Association and the NIH in 1990 in a publication called The Cholesterol Facts, the NIH put this out, the AHA, American Heart Association, put this out. The results of the Framingham study indicate that a 1% reduction in cholesterol corresponds to a 2% reduction in coronary heart disease risk. They said the Framingham paper proved this. When the Framingham paper and the director of the Framingham study said the exact opposite. How can that be? It's because, well, you can come to your own conclusions after I get to the end of this. Okay, the real truth about diet and cholesterol finally emerged in 1992 in an editorial by William Castelli, who replaced Cannell as the Framingham director in 1979. So here's the next director. In 1992, wrote this editorial, William Castelli, C-A-S-T-E-L-L-I. In Framingham, Massachusetts, the more saturated fat one ate, the more cholesterol one ate, the more calories one ate, the lower the person's serum cholesterol. In a subsequent article, Castelli stated that nearly 75% of heart attacks were in people with normal cholesterol levels. Again, that's Framingham study director William Castelli. So then there's another study. They again were trying to prove this, even though Framingham didn't prove it. Here's a Tecumseh Community Health study. It followed 2,000 men and women for 2 decades in an attempt to demonstrate that cholesterol levels were influenced by fat consumption in the previous 24 to 48 hours. Here's what they found. Those who ate the least amount of saturated fat had the highest blood cholesterol levels. That's a Tecumseh study, T-E-C-U-M-S-E-H. Here's the World Health Organization, the MONICA study, Epidemiological Project. It started in 1971, 32 centers in 21 countries around the world. They monitored 10 million men and women aged 25 to 64. All the countries in the top 8 for fat consumption had lower death rates for heart disease than all the 8 countries that consumed the least fat. Again, that's a WHO, WHO study, 10 million people from 1971 to 1981. These are all epidemiological studies. So then they decided to do an interventional trial. What that means is you just take a big group of people, you split them half and half. Half of them you feed low fat, half of them you feed regular high fat. So they did this, the Mr. Fit study, multiple risk factor intervention trial. The largest and most intensive effort to prove the link between diet, cholesterol, and heart disease using the Framingham risk factors. They looked at 12,866 healthy men aged 35 to 57 with no history of heart disease. They randomly assigned them into an intervention group that received treatment for all these risk factors and a controlled group that received the usual standard of care. 8-year follow-up revealed that cholesterol intake had been cut in the group that got counseled to cut their intake. They did. They cut intake of cholesterol by 42%, cut their saturated fat by 28%, cut total calories by 21%. Compared to the control group, there was a modest fall in serum cholesterol. There was no effect on coronary heart disease. The overall results do not show a beneficial effect of coronary heart disease on total mortality from this multi-factor intervention. We're going on now to another study, the Women's Health Initiative. 15-year study, $625 million, 161,808 healthy postmenopausal women followed at 40 clinical centers. Again, most doctors know about this Women's Health Initiative. They evaluated the effect of low-fat, high-fruit, and high-vegetable and high-grain diet on the prevention of heart disease, breast, and colorectal cancers. Conclusion, there was no reduction in coronary heart disease in the low-fat group. Guys, these are big studies. The Women's Health Initiative, Framingham study, the WHO study, 10 million people. These are studies doctors know about, have heard about. How could this be? How could all this data, and again, the name of this book, Fat and Cholesterol Don't Cause Heart Attacks and Statins Are Not the Solution, by Paul Roche, M.D. He has multiple co-authors. Dr. Roche, in this first chapter written by there are multiple doctors writing different chapters of this book. This chapter is Dr. Roche. Dr. Roche points out his opinion and theory is there's conflict of interest from a monetary standpoint. Because obviously the data is not supporting this. And there are doctors who stood up all through this time in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, even to today. And they get mocked, ridiculed, defunded. We'll talk about that here in a second. A defunding of a researcher when he said, wait, homocysteine is a better marker for heart attacks than cholesterol, which now has been proven to be true. But when he first came out and said it, everyone mocked him, ridiculed him. He got defunded. He couldn't get a job for 2 years. He could not get any research grants. Because how do you get homocysteine down? A marker for coronary artery disease? You take B vitamins. B vitamins that cost pennies on the dollar compared to pharmaceuticals that lower your cholesterol. So, Dr. Roche, in Chapter 1, he said, nonetheless, low-fat foods are still advertised as being quote-unquote heart-healthy. A significant portion of the nonprofit group, the American Heart Association's income, which is now close to $800 million a year, again, this is 2016 when this book was published, so AHA is probably over $800 million a year now, but a good portion of that income comes from its Heart Check certification program that began in 1995. This allowed companies to advertise their products as quote-unquote heart-healthy by displaying the AHA red heart with a white check mark logo. The first year fee was $7,500 per product and $4,500 for an annual renewal. Certification, now costing up to $700,000, has been extended to menus and restaurants. And these 700 or so certified products are in six categories that include different types of extra lean meat and seafood, certain nuts, grains, fish, etc. Unfortunately, amongst those still endorsed are chocolate milk, high-sugar breakfast cereals, processed meats full of chemicals and preservatives, as well as other products that are anything but healthy. Is it any coincidence the present obesity epidemic started precisely after these low-fat guidelines were set in place and published in 1980? So when you take fat out of food and you go low-fat and you get the American Heart Association's stamp of approval, that food tastes awful. So you have to put artificial flavor enhancers like MSG, and you have to put a lot of sugar and cheap sugar like high fructose corn syrup. And we've talked about what sugar and carbs do. When you take out fat, you're going to consume more sugar and carbs. That spikes insulin. Insulin tells you to store fat. Insulin is pro-inflammatory. When you mix in heart-healthy, quote-unquote, vegetable oils, as Dr. Kenobi last week talked about, you drive inflammation. When you mix in iron from iron-fortified grains that are in these heart-healthy cereals, voila, inflammation, oxidative stress. You're rusting from the inside out. So his theory is there's the monetary influence and corruption. But really the big, what he really points out next is when you get the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, wanting to get their grain sales up. How do you get grain production and sales up besides mandating ethanol in our fuel? Cereal, breakfast cereal. We've got to get the breakfast cereal onto the plates of every American and getting the bacon and eggs off the plate. So here we go. The dietary guidelines in 1977 first got published by a committee, Senator George McGovern, 1977, the dietary goals for the United States, the Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs. The report was written by Nick Motorin, a former labor reporter for the Providence Journal. So a journalist wrote this dietary guideline. No scientific background or experience was needed by this Nick Motorin. And he utilized Mark Hegstead, a professor of nutrition at Harvard, who was strongly believed in the saturated fat hypothesis for heart disease, even though the data didn't support it. This Harvard nutritionist was a vegetarian, and he just felt like everyone should limit their saturated fat. So despite objections from many doctors and researchers around the world, they went ahead and published these dietary guidelines in 1977. The United States Department of Agriculture was anxious to implement the recommendations, and these recommendations would impact all government institutions that produce food, any government organization like school cafeterias, restaurants, grocery store food producers, the whole, I mean, it trickles throughout the entire society when the government gets behind a recommendation like this, even though the data wasn't there. What Dr. Roche goes on to talk about in this first chapter is the funding. And although leading authorities pointed to the fallacies and the dangers of this hypothesis, and the data did not support it, funding was revoked, including for George Mann. Remember, George Mann, I quoted him initially. He was the co-director of the Framingham Study, and he was a professor of medicine and biochemistry at Vanderbilt, a renowned nutritionist. And when he came out against this, his funding got pulled. We're out of time to talk about all the other examples. Hopefully, I've given you just enough glimpse into the conflict of interest in these government organizations, these committees, these people that sit in an ivory tower and come up with policies. Could it be they're influenced by the number one lobby group in the world, the pharmaceutical industry? Why do pharmaceuticals even advertise? That blows my mind. Even when I was a conventional-minded doctor before I had a deeper training and understanding and continuing medical education into root cause resolution, the only tool I had in my toolbox was pharmaceuticals. Even back then, I thought, why are my patients listening to advertisements? They shouldn't have to do that. I mean, doctors should be trained in medicines, and doctors decide when a medicine's appropriate or not appropriate. We prescribe it when it's appropriate, when we weigh the risk and benefit. Why is there even advertisement? But could it be these advertisement dollars influence the news, the TV, the radio, the newspaper, the internet, Facebook, all of it? It's not conspiracy theory, guys. Go look up how many dollars are given to congressmen from the pharmaceutical industry. Go look at the data that's in this book. Go look at the science and how the science doesn't line up with the government agency's recommendations. It's a sad state that we're in now. That's why the truth must be sought out by the individual consumer. And individual doctors need to go read the data, like Chris Kenobi did, and came to the conclusion that it's diet and lifestyle that drive all this disease. All this chronic disease is a new phenomenon. It wasn't around 100 years ago. That's what we're teaching and preaching at VeritasWellness.Health. We have a class starting first week of September, first week of October, first week of November. Every first week of the month, we're going to start a new class, one-hour Zoom classes with our health coaches called Wellness Navigators. They will teach you how to eat like your ancestors, move, drink, and be at peace. So VeritasWellness.Health, check them out. Next week, we'll talk about breathing, nasal breathing, and how the lack of nasal breathing can drive all this chronic disease, too, when you don't have good oxygenation of your tissues. So stick with us next week. We'll be back. I'm Ben Edwards. You're the Cure.
You've been listening to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, with Veritas Medical. Check out the website, VeritasWellness.Health. VeritasWellness.Health.